May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Mark Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y. I appear on behalf of Mr. John Bartel, who is the appellant in this matter, currently serving approximately a 10-year sentence for a conviction arising out of Hennepin County. Drug possession in the second degree, possession with intent to sell in the first degree. There are three issues that I've briefed for this court for consideration. First, two of which would result in a reversal of his conviction and a remand for a new trial. The third issue, sufficiency of the evidence, would result in reversal, out-and-out dismissal, based upon the insufficiency of the evidence to sustain the jury's verdict. I will submit that the strongest of these three issues for the appellant is the denial of the fair trial. Normally I like to lead with my strongest, but today I'm going to swing for the fences and start with the sufficiency of the evidence argument. And then depending on, with a lot of time allotted, I will address the second issue, denial of the fair trial.
Well, let me take you off your game then. With apologies, but I just want to clarify something just so I understand it. Your brief says, with regard to the issue of the search warrant, at some time, it's on page 6 of your brief, at some time not specified by law enforcement, Officer Collins received information from a cooperating defendant that appellant was storing methamphetamine at the address. I looked at the affidavit, and the affidavit seems to suggest otherwise. You have to draw some inferences, I think, from it. It says that the confidential informant contacted law enforcement within the past 24 hours. And then it says, after that contact, an investigation began. And then it says, during the investigation, the cooperating defendant gave the information. So it seems like it's pretty clear that it's not a time unspecified by law enforcement. The time would have to be within the previous 24 hours of the affidavit. Am I misreading the affidavit?
I read the application differently, Your Honor. I read that the investigation was ongoing for a long period of time involving this particular defendant. It wasn't something that had just come up with the approach of the CRI. This individual was under investigation by law enforcement for some period of time. And at some point in time, once again, not specified in the application.
Okay, I'm going to read to you from the affidavit. This investigation began after your affiant was contacted by a confidential reliable informant within the past 24 hours.
Once again,
Am I misunderstanding, or I'm wondering whether your position is consistent with that statement.
And, Your Honor, I concede that the court is going to read that application the way it is. I obviously can't get after the veracity of those comments, and I understand that the cooperating defendant, the timing of that.
Well, you said a moment ago that this investigation was a long and ongoing investigation. I'm wondering how we can draw that. Is that statement supported somewhere in the affidavit, which says, to the contrary, that the investigation began within the last 24 hours?
And, Your Honor, my review of the record, I couldn't find the page number in the trial transcript for the court right now. But I would indicate to the court that my client has an extensive criminal history. He lives in this area, and these officers knew about my client before 24 hours before this traffic stop.
Oh, no question they knew about him. But you were saying that this investigation into this matter, I mean, just because someone is known to law enforcement and has a criminal history doesn't mean that they're under constant investigation. The affidavit says this particular investigation began within 24 hours, and more to the point that you were making earlier in your brief, that we have no idea of knowing when this confidential, not the cooperating defendant communicated to law enforcement. The affidavit says the investigation began within 24 hours, and after the investigation began, that's when we heard from the cooperating defendant.
And, Your Honor, once again, the way that that, I don't think that that, we can, you can read that affidavit as being drafted chronologically. I did, there was no specified time with regard to what, how long before the application that, that meeting occurred. If you want to read it that way, I don't think that changes my argument.
Okay.
To the, and I'll let you get to issue three soon, but I do have one question about issue one, and that is this. Your argument about the sufficiency of the evidence relates to your client's contention that he does not reside at the apartment, which is number five, correct?
That's correct, on Stevens Street, that's correct.
And the search warrant about which you are complaining in argument number one relates to a search of the premises at apartment number five.
That's correct.
How does he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in apartment five where he does not reside?
Well, standing, once again, aside, I'll address standing in this way. The state attributed items in that apartment belonging to him. The state accused him of having two residences. So it was the state's assertion that he had standing.
Your client asserted he did not reside there.
He didn't testify at the suppression hearing.
But in
the
his application, statement to police, he said, that's not my apartment.
That's correct.
Right. So if I store contraband at Judge Ross's residence and you get a search warrant to search his residence, do I have standing to complain about that?
No.
Okay.
If you're if the government accuses that you reside there part-time and your clothing is there and your paycheck stubs are there, that
what if I was playing softball and I left some pair of tennis shoes and some shorts there at his house because I showered after the softball game? Does that give me standing?
No. Unless you're an overnight guest at the time.
I'm not going that far.
Right. Sorry.
Agreed.
So there is standing. There is a standing issue that was not addressed by the trial court, was not argued by the state. When this issue of sufficiency came up before the trial court, the state never argued that the defendant did not have standing to challenge the search of the Stevens Avenue apartment.
Fair enough. And then,
if you're going to engage in this nefarious conduct, I'm glad it's with Judge Ross's house, not mine.
You can get to sufficiency then, because I think I agree with you. That may be your best argument.
And I'm going to go really quick now because I have about 7.5 minutes left. The with regard to splitting my time between these two, State v. Sam is a stronger circumstantial evidence of construction, constructive possession, of controlled substance cases than this case. State v. Sam, the drugs are, and the firearm are found in between the driver and passenger. There's furtive gestures toward the center console. There's some drugs on the passenger. There's some drugs in the glove box.
The gun is in the center console, and Sam, drugs are in front of the passenger and in his pocket.
There's also drugs in the center console, I would argue.
I wrote Sam. I'm not sure that you're right about that.
So we've got, in this case, we've got drugs on the ground outside the passenger window of an individual, Robert Senn, who was prosecuted for those drugs and pled guilty and was convicted of possessing those drugs. The passenger was accused of and pled guilty to possessing those drugs. They are found outside the vehicle. This testimony at trial established cross-examination of these officers that this was in basically a half a block of my client's residence. So he lived, it was like a driveway that if it went through, it was an alleyway, you'd get to your apartment. But he didn't go all the way through. And so this driveway is right by the apartment on 23rd Avenue.
The place where he says he lives.
He says he lives, right, within a block. And that's why police were told, you'll find him driving in that area. He's going to have some methamphetamine on him. That was the tip. Now, those are the drugs on the ground. The record in the trial, contrary to comments by the appellant's counsel in his brief and comments by trial counsel on occasion, there was a scale box found on the ground, a box for a scale found on the ground. That's in the trial transcript. No scale present at the scene. The apartment that my client, the second apartment, that is owned by, rented by Krista Schroeder. She has drugs on her when she's leaving. The drugs are in the house. Apartment 5 on Stevens Avenue. There's drugs in her pocket. There's drugs in her apartment. She's just leaving when they go in to do the search warrant. Nobody has seen my client at Stevens Avenue apartment at any time soon, recently. He wasn't seen leaving there. He wasn't seen going there. There's no connection, no evidence that my client was there, other than this, once again, clothing from work that was left behind, old work shirts, old, you know, paycheck stubs, things that evidenced that he used to live
recent
there.
Recent pay stubs?
I'm sorry?
Recent pay stubs?
Yeah, there was, I think it was about a month ago, about a month prior. But then when you go into, they do a search on the 23rd Avenue apartment, and they find boxes, and they find my client's flat panel, and there's evidence that it was recently moved into. So it the evidence that they collected in this investigation corroborated what he said. I used to live over on Stevens, but now I live on 23rd. Now, so the Sam case and Passion Christensen, which was an unpublished decision of this court, there's a lot of cases that have stronger circumstantial evidence of constructive possession than this one, and this there's nothing to tie the drugs directly. They're not in an area under my client's exclusive possession control.
They were behind a picture or something, weren't they?
I apologize.
Weren't they behind a picture?
Yes, a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And we have pictures of Marilyn Monroe in our house, but my wife has purchased all of them. So this is arguably Krista Schrader's picture of Marilyn Monroe. It's her apartment. It's her drugs. She's got drugs on her pocket when she walks out. Now, I want to move quickly to, unless there's any questions about the Al Nassar silver nail argument, I think that the record speaks for itself and warrants reversal and dismissal. This trial was exceedingly unfair. It was so unfair that it would be a travesty not to reverse what happened in this trial. We had aggressive law enforcement, an aggressive prosecutor, a defense attorney who continued to object and get overruled again and again. And what was admitted at trial amounted to spiegel evidence that was speculation that within 2 days of my client's arrest, 2 days prior, the 16th, the testimony is the 16th of January, 2018.
This is a text message.
A text message referencing, they speculated it was from Sen. They speculated it was to my client. This phone has never even attributed to my client. There's two phones that are recovered, and that it's you could argue it could have been my client's, but it's not registered to him, and it isn't tracked to him. So now this text message, as I'm sure you've read, it was something along the lines of, you got $3,000 in a pound, and, you know, I got nothing or something. It was something like that. And this was extrapolated by the officer that in his training experience, this is evidence of a drug jack. And not only is it evidence of a drug jack, the defendant did it. And it was Spriegel, prior bad acts evidence. Now, sometimes Spriegel evidence, we debate on review, well, should it really fall within the 404B? Was it more prejudicial than probative? I mean, there was no Spriegel motion. And keep in mind, this is not inadvertently blurted out. There was, if you look at the transcript, there was an exhibit that had this.
You're arguing that this is, you know, I know you don't have much time, but you may not want to use it emphasizing that, by emphasizing that this was improper evidence. I think the state concedes that this evidence was improper.
Okay.
So maybe you can turn your attention to the prejudice prong of the
I would analysis. Refer the court to a case that I apologize is not in my briefs, Minnesota Supreme Court, State v. Williams, 1994. Issued December 23rd, 1940. It's 525 Northwest 2nd, 538.
That didn't make it into your brief. I'm just curious. Since you knew you were going to argue about it today, did you let opposing counsel know that that was going to be a subject of your
I argument? Did not.
Okay.
And the Williams court, there's an individual who travels to St. Paul on a train. She gets off the train. Has a duffel bag that has a bunch of crack cocaine in it. The appeal, the first half of the court's decision does not reverse based upon the racial makeup of the jury, state striking minorities, but then reverses on the admission of the drug courier profile evidence, which was what was permitted here, and one moment, please. The comments from the court are very enlightening because the defense counsel in Williams does not object, and yet the error is seen as way too prejudicial to permit the conviction to stand. This is not collateral information. This is almost res gestae comments. This explained everything.
Was there a jury instruction cautioning in that case?
There wasn't. In Williams?
Yes.
I am not certain.
There was in this case.
There was not in this case. As a matter of fact, this was no Spriegel evidence in this case. What the court did was compound the error of admitting the prior bad act without notice by stating that they gave a curative instruction from Spriegel. What the court should have said was disregard. There's no proof a crime occurred. There's no proof that this defendant did it, and you can't consider that testimony whatsoever. Instead, the court said, don't convict him for being a drug jack guy 2 days ago. That's not what he's on trial for. They ratified the speculation. The court ratified the speculation.
But caution how that ratification can be used by instructing it can't be used.
It said that he's only on trial for what he's been charged
with, right,
and not to disregard.
I mean, if the jury followed the judge's instructions, then there would be no actual prejudice. I mean, I know that your argument is that we can't expect the jury to have actually done that, but just as a matter of logic, if the jury followed the judge's cautionary instruction to a T, then there would be no prejudice for that, at least for that evidence. Am I correct about that, or am I misunderstanding?
I think that's true, but you can't unhear it.
Right.
And it's so unnecessary. Keep in mind that trial counsel did object to this exhibit as hearsay, and he was overruled. Now, when we talk about a lack of foundation for Spriegel, that's very similar to a hearsay, right? He's saying, look, this evidence lacks foundation. He tried to object to this exhibit and was overruled by the trial court. Then it was admitted without any proper Spriegel warning, and the curative instruction, once again, was insufficient to guarantee a fair trial. When you look at what...
You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Understood.
Okay.
Thank you.
Respondent.
May it please the court, Patrick Laughlin for the state of Minnesota. We are asking this court to confirm appellant's conviction because none of his issues that he's raised on appeal are with merit. Judge Rodenberg, to address your initial question about standing, I guess I kind of agree with appellant's counsel about this because the state's position always was that appellant resided there in some fashion. I didn't think it appropriate to make the standing argument, although that did pop in my head as well, the inconsistency of those two things. But the state's position was always that he lived there. I'll start with the sufficiency of the evidence and the comparison to State versus Sam.
Does the sufficiency of the evidence depend upon him living there?
So for the possession of the...
the methamphetamine in apartment number 5?
It depends on him having constructive possession of that, yes. And so I think him residing there, the state's position was he resided there, yes. I don't think the state presented a theory of the case to the jury that he simply stored his drugs there. And that's based on the fact that the key was found at his apartment. And I think by virtue of the defense calling his current girlfriend to testify that now he lives with me, the jury's verdict is an express rejection of that testimony. So in a way, it's an express rejection of direct testimony that strengthens, direct evidence that strengthens the circumstantial evidence in this case. One thing I think that everyone has to keep in mind when you're looking at whether this evidence is sufficient is that possession of contraband, whether it's a gun, whether it's the drugs, whatever it is, can be joint. Yes, KS had drugs on her person coming out of the house. Yes, there were two people in the car where the drugs were found outside the vehicle. It's very possible that they're all using and or selling these drugs together. I reviewed the record, or my notes from the record, I should say, briefly while counsel was arguing about whether it's a box or a scale outside the truck. And my notes say it was a scale. I don't have the actual transcript in front of me. I apologize for that. But I think whether it's a box to a scale or a scale itself probably doesn't move the ball that much in terms of the state's argument. Another thing, the way that some of these issues interplay with each other, as outlined in my brief when I'm talking about how Officer Collins testified that suspects often don't want to talk about what happened, there I noted that trial counsel was able to get a lot of defendant's self-serving hearsay out in this trial, that he vehemently denied possessing the drugs, that he didn't live at 1913 Stevens, all of that. Again, that information was in front of the jury and they rejected it. That is the defendant's version of events, although it didn't come from his mouth on the witness stand. It is his version of events. So while I argued sufficiency under a circumstantial standard, because I think it is the appropriate one, you do have some direct evidence to the contrary that's rejected by the jury. And that strengthens all of the circumstances I outlined in my brief. And I don't think this case is at all like Sam because of two separate places where drugs are, and most importantly, the actions that the appellant took that indicate consciousness of guilt, the erratic driving conduct and lying about where he was going, and then saying that the key to 1913 was an old girlfriend's key, which, I mean, obviously could be true, but in light of all the other circumstances, was extremely doubtful. I'll move from that on to the Spriegel issue, unless there are more sufficiency questions. Okay. What I wanted to say about this was that, again, it relates to the sufficiency question. Had this been a closer case, this would be more problematic. This should not have been admitted. I would direct the court to the prosecutor's post-trial motion to deny a new trial, where he talks about kind of how this went down. And I think it's clear from the transcript that when that testimony came out of Officer Collins' mouth that everyone was kind of taken aback. I do agree that the judge should have said completely disregard it. But as Judge Ross pointed out, the judge did say you can't use this to convict him. I would also note, and I'm familiar with the Williams case cited by counsel. By the way, I use it as well when talking about cumulative error. I would also note that had the Spriegel process been followed in this case, had they filed notice, had they had the hearing, had they gone through the Ness prongs, I think this would have been admissible as Spriegel, perhaps sanitized to take out the robbery aspect of it, but to show that he had obtained meth on a prior date could help explain why he's in possession of it now.
Well, so I think, but it wasn't produced at Spriegel.
It wasn't. It wasn't noticed. That process wasn't followed. But I think the fact that it likely could have been admissible as that lessens the prejudice. I rely upon the Meldrum case to say that, you know, although I think the proper instruction here should have been completely disregard, the absence of that instruction doesn't warrant reversal absent, you know, extreme circumstances. Yes, the one other thing I wanted to say about the Spriegel robbery text message.
Were there two phones found?
Yes, and to that point, again, I understood it that they found the phone on defendant's person. I would point you to page 56 of volume 2 of the transcript for that. But in any event, you'll recall the testimony of Sergeant Carter was that the passenger was looking at his phone and wouldn't look up. I think by virtue of that, you can infer he knew whose phone
was. Two people, two phones, exactly. Not this one, must be that one.
Right, yes. And the other point I wanted to make about the Spriegel on the phone, and again, ties in with the sufficiency argument. If defendant had only been charged with the drugs at 1913 Stevens, right? If they had had the information from the CI that he was storing them there and he's going to be in this place, and they bust him, but he doesn't have drugs here, and it's only drugs there, and they're behind Marilyn Monroe, and yes, he's got a key, but he denies living there, that would be a tougher case. That would be a much harder case. Then that text message of that robbery and the $3,000 and the pound, that would be a necessary link, or at least a critical link, in the state's case to proving possession at another location, because there would be a physical distance there that would be hard for the state to overcome. Here, the drugs are also right outside the car, along with a scale or a box to a scale. So I just don't think it's close enough for the Spriegel issue, which again, shouldn't have happened. I don't think it's close enough for that to warrant reversal. In terms of the search warrant, again, I pointed the court to the Yarborough case. I think that that is the current standard on what a sufficient nexus here. I think that this isn't a close case even without the key on his person, but he does have the key, shows he has access to the house.
Can you address the conclusory statements of the cooperating defendant in the affidavit? We don't know. The affidavit doesn't reveal how this defendant gained knowledge.
Right. I agree with that. And I think that your questions about the timing of it were apt, too. I think you can read it all to say this all started within 24 hours, but then it's weird because he goes into a cooperating defendant that you think he would have mentioned at the beginning if that was going on as well. So the timing is weird. It is conclusory, but at the end of the day, it's two informants. It's two informants whose information are both heavily corroborated. The CRI's information is corroborated when they find him in the place at the time, looking at State versus Ross, timing, vehicle, all of that matter in finding probable cause. And then the cooperating defendant's information is corroborated by the fact that KS also lives at that address. So it's conclusory. It would be nice to have a basis of knowledge. The timing is weird. But ultimately, there's enough corroboration to uphold PC for that warrant. And as for the nexus issue, again, the key gets them the link to that house. They use that key to go inside, and then they find the methamphetamine in there. With my remaining time, I'll talk briefly about the testimony by Officer Collins about the cell phone in general, not the Spriegel robbery, but the outgoing and ingoing messages. Again, I point the court to State versus Barajas for that, which it's important that appellant mentioned State versus Williams, 1994. That's kind of the Barajas precursor, where the Supreme Court says you can't do drug courier profile evidence, but we're not holding that you can't have an officer explain how seemingly innocent items are used in drug dealing. And so where you draw that line may sometimes be muddy, but in this case, it's not. Officer Collins explained he's seen cell phones like this before. All these incoming messages and no outgoing messages indicates drug dealing, and I think kind of as a matter of common sense, a jury could infer that as well. And this case had other implements that he had to explain, scales, large amounts of cash, all of that, and that makes it very similar to Barajas. So I think that addresses most of the issues on appeal. Are there any other questions before I end my argument?
It appears there are not.
Thank you, Judge.
Now, Mr. Kelly, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time. As you're approaching the podium, there was actually marijuana in the middle section in Sam, but not methamphetamine. So I stand partially corrected.
Clarify. I want to refer the court quickly to page 52, counsel.
There's a toggle at the bottom.
Got it. Thank you. So briefly, to page 52, that is where Sergeant Carter testifies that a digital scale box is found outside.
Page 52 of which volume?
It's listed as volume one. On my trial transcript, it's basically the first witness being called at trial, Sergeant Carter.
So trial page 52.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
this idea that the drug Jack text message is might have been admitted under Spiegel, I would submit that there's no evidence there even was a drug Jack. What it said was you got $3,000 and a pound. What is that? It doesn't even say after we put a gun to his head, after we broke into the house. It's total speculation that a crime even occurred, let alone speculation that this defendant even committed that crime.
I think that's conceded. I thought that was all conceded by the state.
Okay. I thought that they were making a different argument. As far as this, the effect of these cumulative errors, when you read the whole transcript of the trial, what you find is that these officers, Carter and Collins, testify kind of in unison with each other. And Officer Collins talks about the drug interdiction training. Well, tell me about that. Well, I go to training in New York and other cities, and I find about how we get tips. And then when we get tips, then we find people traveling with drugs. And Sergeant Carter gets on the stand, and the prosecutor says, tell me about the day in question. Sergeant Carter says, well, we got a tip.
He actually said confidential informant.
Confidential informant gave us a tip. That's how my day started, and that's how this stop started. I got a tip. And then they cut off. Gee, you weren't supposed to say that. And this is the defense attorney keeps objecting and keeps getting overruled on what I think are hearsay. It's hearsay evidence. It's speculative. There are some objections sustained, but there's multiple objections overruled to hearsay. About the neighbors that he pulled into a house, pulled in his driveway and said, I know the people that live here. Two elderly couples are outside kind of looking at what's going on. And the officer testifies. I asked them, they said, the occupants said they didn't know him. Objection, hearsay. Overruled. Why isn't that hearsay? It's going to the truth of the matter asserted. You're calling the guy a liar with hearsay, and you're not calling the occupants of those houses. But this is just one example of dozens of examples in this trial that all added up to sufficiency of the evidence. Keep in mind that the jury is not given Al Nassar Silvernail analysis under the turnip seed case. The judge doesn't have to tell the jury if there's any inference other than guilt, you must acquit. But they're never told that. They're talking about, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond all possibility of doubt. This court, the trial court, knows the law, but the jury never hears that law. This
yeah, but Harris was decided. I mean, I agree with you. That would be the simpler way to resolve this whole problem. I agree 100%, but Harris was decided.
That you can give the instruction?
No, that you don't have to.
Right, exactly. The trial court, the jury never hears this. But we know it's the law. And what happens here in this trial is the scale, the thumb is on the scale again and again and again. The witnesses talk about stuff they're not supposed to talk about. They reference informants that there was a discovery demand made for the identity of the CRI in pretrial motion by counsel. And the trial court said, you don't get him because he's not a trial witness. And the first thing they talk about is information they got from an informant that's confidential. It's just blatant. When you read the whole record, it's blatant. And what happens is this guy gets convicted for stuff that was found in proximity to the passenger in another person's apartment. Keep in mind, when they searched him, he had no drugs on him. When they searched his car, there was no paraphernalia in his car. When they went to the apartment on 23rd, there was no drugs there. The stuff on the ground and the stuff in the apartment, which they say had a unique tie to the bag. When you read this testimony, it's comical that it's a unique tie. It's a sandwich bag with a knot. He says normally it's tied down lower to the drugs, or it's in a Ziploc. And that's the identifying unique bag. There is nothing unique about it. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. That is the last of the matters on for oral argument this morning. We're going to close in recess.